Hello, hello. This is Kinnack, also known as Landon Winkler, coming back for the 7 Squared Metroplexity podcast. Yes, good old 49, I think, unless it was... 49. Let's jump in there for any infuriating hints and bamboozling questions. And hope that we get some good ones in there. There aren't too many questions, so this shouldn't be a 2-hour extravaganza, but as I haven't read the questions in advance, I can't promise anything on that regards. First off, we've got some questions from CryptoDynamic. Hey, Crypto, how are the trips to Japan and PaizoCon? Did I actually not have a podcast after I came back from Japan? I guess maybe not. Japan was awesome. We were there for about 18 days, something like that. And we got to visit Shirakawa, which is little city in Fukushima province. Unfortunately, probably best known for nuclear meltdown. Shouldn't say meltdown, nuclear problems following the tsunami a few years back. We obviously spent some time in Tokyo. We visited Kyoto and Nara, the old capitals. We visited Hiroshima and Kagoshima, which is a area down towards the south that is basically right next to an active volcano, which is pretty sweet. So we got some good spread out from like the little towns to the places with all of the historical significance and all of that. The probably like the coolest thing is that so the reason we visited Shirakawa is because Puyo is a fan of a local hero there. And I've probably talked about local heroes on the podcast before, but it's basically a sort of, like a local mascot, almost. Think Lex, like Phoenix Jones, and more like, Brutus Buckeye here in Columbus, but like the mascot of like a university, but instead of being the university, it's for the entire city. The mascot there is the local hero, I should say. It's a guy by the name of Daoraisa. That's obviously the hero character's name, not the performer / author, everything. And they basically like put on stage plays with some villains that Puyo friggin' loves, and lots of fun stuff like that. They just put out a movie recently. Like an actual full-length movie that we are trying to get shown here in Columbus. We'll see if that happens. Lots of cool stuff with that. But we, Puyo has sort of the a lot of her friends in Japan are friends because they're also fans of Daoraisa or Transformers or Overlord or what have you. And so when we were in Shirakawa, we basically roped in like 4 or 5 of like his hardest core fans and did like a group tour of the city guided by him, with Puyo sort of like acting as a translator and him doing what he could in his English, which was substantially better than my Japanese. Probably about online with Liz's Japanese. Hers got surprisingly good, surprisingly quickly. She is a very talented individual in a number of ways, and learning languages is definitely one of those. We got to see the entire city, and they had some old castles there. I guess I should say an old castle and like the first public park in Japan, and like lots of little stuff like that. And like I got to have like tea ceremony with a costumed superhero, and like there are just some weird experiences like that, and like stopping several times during the day, like with little kids running up and being like, Daoraisa-san, Daoraisa-san, and him like stopping and taking pictures with them and, you know, doing the poses and whatnot. That was pretty great. That was probably like the most unique experience there, but there was a lot of good stuff. One of the things that we noticed while we were in Kyoto is, we'd been going to a lot of, I mean, just like going down the list of like, there was a certain, you know, collection of sites that you're supposed to visit. Liz sort of going off of like the list of sites that like, you know, are famously Japanese, and me going off the list of sites that you're supposed to visit when you're doing a school trip in anime or manga, because there's like a handful of things that like you, that the students do in all of them. So we sort of like, we're like, oh yeah, like they were just the first things to come to mind. So we ended up hitting all of those, which is very funny in retrospect. But after like, I think it was after our first day in Kyoto, we were like, we ran into the UNESCO World Heritage logo like a zillion times, just constantly. And I had not known what the logo was. Like, it's just sort of like this glyph that was on all of these things. And like, when you were in a country that you're not familiar with, and don't really like have a good command of the written language of, especially if that language is Japanese or Chinese or Korean or what have you, it, like, you just sort of start to skip over, you know, characters that you don't recognize. I sort of subconsciously noticed it coming up a couple of times, and then noticed that it was the World Heritage Sites, which is, if you think of it as the list of places that could be put into civilization games as wonders, like, that's not far from what it is, but it's like an official UN recognition of, you know, this site is important to world history, whether it be something that we built or is just something like really cool that exists in the natural world. We were looking, once we realized what it was, we ended up digging into something that we should have done before we went, of like, you know, the list of World Heritage Sites and the places that we were. And it was like Kyoto by itself had like 17 or something, which was about as many as the entire continent of Australia, which is not like, I don't think is like favoritism or anything. It's just sort of displays like how thick on the ground like the historical stuff there is. And we got to do some pretty cool historical stuff. We got to see, I mean, a lot of castles, a lot of shrines, climb, not Mount Fuji, because we were there at absolutely the wrong time of year for that. We would have basically just been walking in clouds the entire time, and it would have been A, miserable, and B, we couldn't have seen anything. Even, like, from the ground, it would have just been, hey, there's a cloud bank with, like, a vaguely Fuji-shaped shadow in it. Climbed to like Fushimi Inari, which is a relatively famous shrine that has like, if you see a shrine that has so many of the torii, the like sort of orange or stone gates, you're just like, there's just like hallways of the gates. That's Fushimi Inari. And got to climb to the top of that, because that was pretty cool. And visited a ton of other shrines. And a number of Pokemon centers, because Puyo is a bigger Pokemon fan than I am, but we both are, and Liz was willing to put up with it to a limited extent. And like the Sky Tree in Tokyo, which was sort of funny in that the Sky Tree is like major tourist attraction in Tokyo. Like, it's would be sort of like not unlike something like the Empire State Building or not coming up with a great example for somewhere like Chicago or the like the Space Needle, places like that, where it's like the building is famous and then there's like a ton of shopping. I don't know if there's any shopping in the Space Needle or the Empire State Building. I'm just assuming here. There's a lot of shopping in this country. And we were there during Golden Week, which is basically the week that more or less every Japanese worker ends up having off, except for people in the tourism industry. And there's a collection of holidays there, but it ends up being that they like have merged into one, you know, week long holiday. And so we were at like this major tourist attraction in, you know, Tokyo, which is obviously not a small city by any means. And, during really like the busiest time of the year for internal tourism in Japan. And it was still very reasonable. Not because, like, there weren't an absolute ton of people there, and certainly not because I enjoy being around tons of people, because I absolutely do not, but just culturally, they've developed a lot of better ways of handling that, compared to my experiences in, like, large or even mid-sized American cities, where it's, like, a lot of people jostling around, being loud, and, like, there's a little bit of jostling, for sure, but, like, very quiet, like, almost, like, not quite, like, meditative, but, like, compared to somewhere like Chicago, the exact same, like, number of people packed in as densely in Tokyo is just, like, you know, like, you could lull yourself to sleep, with it. It was really nice. Like, I really appreciated that. It also helps not being able to understand the language very well, because, like, to the extent that people are talking, which is not nearly as much, but to the extent that they are, it's easier to ignore it, which is sort of sound. So there's a little bit of that, too. And the sort of unfair advantage of just being, like, taller than everyone else, which makes it way less claustrophobic. But anyway, just the... yeah, even the most absurd crushes that we were in, like, accidentally ending up on a subway in Tokyo during rush hour, in, like, the rush hour direction, like, the classic, like, crammed in, can't even move subway experience. Like, even that was very, very quiet and peaceful. And, of course, like, obviously there's still some negative stuff, with Japan, which we also hit to varying degrees, like the fact that there's a week that everybody gets off, and, like, for a lot of people, that's basically, like, their vacation for the year, it's one of the very few places in, like, the industrialized world that makes, like, American labor practices, look good, and a lot of, like, problems with gender and stuff, that were evident even during our short stay. So it's not all, like, you know, sunshine and roses, but it was pretty fucking awesome. And would definitely suggest for, like, I mean, if you're into geek culture, you probably have at least, like, periphery, like, Japanese interest. And I would say that by itself would probably make it worth it. And obviously if you're, you know, super into anime and whatnot, like, there's something to be said for, you know, at least getting to, you know, Akiba once in your life, which for anyone listening who is not a total otaku or weeaboo, depending on your preferred nomenclature, Akiba, the full name is Akihabara, is a sort of neighborhood in Japan. It's named after, like, a particular train stop, as many neighborhoods in Tokyo are. But it's basically, it gets back into some of, like, the interesting, like, not all sunshine cultural things, in that, like, there's a very strong undercurrent of, conformity. Like, you like what you're supposed to like, you do what you're supposed to do, and if you like different weird things, that is still something like can be provided to you, but it gets sort of like segregated off almost. So it's, so there's Akiba, which is basically, you know, like all of the geeky stuff. Like there's a lot of stuff that we in America would think of geeky that's sort of normal in Japan. Like, I mean, reading manga, watching anime, like these are like, we were on the train, like watching like a 40-year-old, maybe even 50-year-old businessman, like in his, you know, in his suit reading, actually sort of like borderline R, like probably is just considered like, you know, sort of PG-13 over there, but like would be considered R here probably because breasts, you know. But was reading, yeah, some borderline lewd manga, just like chilling on the train, like totally normal business dude. And that was not uncommon by any means. But like once you get into like the serious fandom, like that's a separate beast, and you get sort of like cordoned off for that. But the interesting thing with that, going back into the gender thing, so it was like Akiba, which we outside the country very much think as like, you know, the place for otaku, and like where all the geeky people and all the geeky stuff is, which is fairly true. And like there are still maid cafes and owl cafes and all sorts of interesting cafes and a really good ramen shop, which admittedly could have been anywhere in Japan, but it happened to be in Akiba and it was amazing. But there's also, I'm not sure if I'm going to remember which neighborhood this is correctly. I want to say Haruya, but there's another, like, totally separate neighborhood where all of the sort of, like, girl geek stuff is. So, like, there's this weird undercurrent in Akiba and, like, in sort of, like, externally presented Japanese geek culture, that is like, you know, it all sort of like you're not conforming to the large culture, but you're conforming to like the geek culture. But what we see is that is very much like their geek male culture. There's a separate geek female culture, that is sort of segregated off, and they have their own bookstores largely and things like that. Not in the sense that like, I mean, like a lot of the sort of like normal person stuff will get all mixed together. Like you'll be able to get shonen and shoujo, like boys and girls manga, basically anywhere, like even at the 7-Eleven, what have you. But the once you get into stuff more along like extreme fandom or like fan works, like doujin, or like pornography, it gets very much, like, broken out by gender. So, like, Akiba has, like, these huge, like, towering bookstores, a number of them. And even in the ones that are, like, normal floor, normal floor, normal floor, porn, those porn floors, usually, like, one of them will be a dude's floor. They might both be dude's floors, but in the rare cases that they have porn there for women, it will be sort of like portioned off as a separate entity. I'm not sure if there's like a weird legal requirement or if it's just a cultural thing, but it'll be like a totally different store than the rest of the establishment. And then, you know, on sort of a macro level, the neighborhoods are separated like that. And it's very subtle, but very interesting. And ended up talking to a number of Puyo's friends who fall into sort of that category, which, I mean, we would just call, like, geeks or geek girls, but usually end up being called sort of unpleasant. I mean, the literal translation of the term for that in Japanese is, would translate as like rotten girl, basically. Like basically like you have failed at being a woman and there, and like all this geek stuff, as opposed to otaku, which basically means house, as I recall. But yeah, it's just sort of like, oh yeah, this is just a person who like sits in their house. Sort of almost like a homebody, but has grown this sort of geeky connotation. But that is a term that is by and large used for men. Yeah, there's just like, there's a lot of interesting layers there that, interestingly, I felt like there were a lot of things that I was not, that I hadn't picked up on in anime and manga that were very much there. But like, I hadn't thought that they were like actual things. Like, it's sort of like there are certain story tropes that you go along with that are like, oh, you know, our harem anime, like the main character has no spine, but all of the girls like him anyway. And like, you know, the school is set up like this and the characters work this way. And there's, you know, always like the school trip to Kyoto and you go to like these three places. And like, so like a lot of that is obviously just sort of tropes of the genre. But then some of it is actually just like things that are perfectly normal that seem weird from, seem like they may or may not be real from an outside perspective. And a lot of those ended up being real, and some things that I didn't even really particularly notice ended up being real as well. But anyway, Japan, really interesting, really cool. 5 stars, would suggest it. Go to Shirakawa. There are nice people. Admittedly, probably want to bring someone who actually speaks Japanese, because not as much with the bilingualness like once you get out of major cities and tourist areas. But Paizo-kan was super cool. We were mostly going there. Well, I mean, Liz works full-time for Paizo on a sort of like contract-type basis, but that's her actual day job right now. So she wasn't technically required to go, and wasn't like, because of like how contract stuff works, like couldn't be required to go even if they wanted to require her to, but she wanted to, you know, drop in, see all of her coworkers, talk to the fans, all that stuff. So we went and did that, and that was a lot of fun. Stayed in an Airbnb in Seattle for a good like 10 days or something, so sort of like the con, and then a couple days on either side so she could actually get into the office and work with her coworkers. Crazy, right? All that stuff. And so that was pretty cool. Ended up picking up sort of around and related to that some freelance work on Pathfinder and Starfinder stuff, which I guess thing I didn't even mention that I went to because I forgot that not everyone knows that I go to Gen Con every year and have forever, but we were in Indianapolis for Gen Con, and admittedly it would have been impossible to find me because there were like 70,000 people or something like that this year. But I also went to Gen Con and Starfinder, which is a new RPG from Paizo that Liz did a lot of editing on and stuff like that. So we went and actually cosplayed some Starfinder characters, which was sort of fun because we were like the first people cosplaying for the game. but it ended up selling out like a couple of hours into day one. Like they've had a number of huge releases before at the con, and they brought like half again as much as their previous biggest release, which sold out like Friday or Saturday and was considered like a pretty major success. But yeah, they brought half again as much and sold out on Thursday. and pretty early at that. And so, yeah, that was, everyone was expecting it to do well. No one was really expecting it to do that well. And there were a lot of really grumpy people until they realized, like, the sheer magnitude of the amount of purchases that had happened there. Yeah, if you're into science fantasy, which is kind of what we do here in Metroplexity, but more like space opera meets sword and sorcery than like cyberpunk meets sort of like urban fantasy, dark badness, Cronenberg, whatever, stuff we do here. So yeah, there is some good stuff there. So yeah, if you're into that stuff, definitely look it up. It's pretty cool. We just actually started a Starfinder campaign Monday night. So that would be 2 days ago, from now. And that's, fun and exciting. And we've got a whole crew. Nobody, I guess, that you know, well, other than Liz, I guess. Liz is in that one. And, I'm running it, and Liz is sort of the backup GM, because there are two other games that we're also running, which are Pathfinder, and the Sunday game is Strange Aeons, which is like, Pathfinder tends to have some Lovecraft stuff, like their creative director for Pathfinder is an even bigger Lovecraft fan than I am, and I'm not like, I don't want to call myself like a super fan or anything, but like, I'm like, woo, Lovecraft, like very like formative, you know, writing. In my life, but the Strange Aeons Adventure Path, as the name sort of implies indirectly, is like 100% like balls to the walls Lovecraft all day every day, and Puyo is in that one and is enjoying the hell out of herself, which is good. And Durgan, I guess, who has who's a friend of ours who played Metroplexity some back in the day and has showed up a couple of times, is also in that group, along with a few newer friends. Okay, whew, then on to the Metroplexity stuff. So yeah, it only took us, 30 minutes. I should have mentioned this at the beginning. I'm trying a new audio setup because I have, I'm switching over fully to, the laptop that I got last year when everything got stolen, which I'm sure is on a podcast past if you don't know what I'm talking about, but I was also lent a desktop, and I finally have gotten, I've been using both, but the desktop has just started, I mean, it was very powerful for its time, but very old, and it started getting a bit flaky. So I'm getting everything moved over to the laptop now, but I had been doing all of my recordings on the desktop, so no idea how this is going to sound. I apologize if it is Crackletown, USA. But yeah, on to Metroplexity stuff. You know, half an hour in, I was like, oh, this will take half an hour, so hopefully the Metroplexity questions are pretty short, or we're going to be here for longer than I was expecting, which is obviously not the biggest problem in the world. I think we'll be having Halloween in downtown this year, or is there not an appropriate place opened up yet? If necessary, there is, like, I have all of the code in for, like, the upper parts of downtown, and if I need to, at some point, I can just basically flip a switch and make that happen. So that may very easily end up happening. But I do plan to have Halloween downtown at a cool new location that you haven't gotten more than hints of yet. It's shown up a few times in sort of flavor text, but not somewhere you've gotten to visit to this point. I'm actually putting together the, sort of took a break putting in together the art request to give this podcast. So it should be pretty cool. Do you think any cybercrafting will venture into armory territory, metal-reinforced bones or the like? Yeah, it's very likely that you'll end up seeing something along the lines of, like, dermal plating and so forth that can be created with armory. More wanted to get, you know, the sort of like fundamental stuff in, but the it absolutely might show up with armory, and the off chance there might be some weird ones with chemistry, not seeing many options for, you know, sushi cybernetics, but never say never. And that might just show up as a small update, like the like your Golem Hearts idea did. So, wouldn't worry too much about that absence for the time being. A bit of a long one to give context. Argath recently found that counterculture cyborg can prevent you from peacefully entering the front doors of the Midgard's records vault, and I assume they'll also affect other corp buildings like the Midgard one downtown. Since Ocean Tusk also counts for this purpose, you have something doing that which can't be reversed. For now, a reset will do that, but eventual skill perming might make that a problem. I know the Kingdom of Loathing Deaths said that it's a design decision in the game not to have skills that will hurt people if learned permanently. What are your thoughts on that? There are definitely some places where you'll get interesting results once we move into sort of like perming skills and things like that. You will... Someone with Ocean's Touch will want to poke around a little more carefully around that. I don't think that there are any reasons to be concerned. It's still a few months away, but any chance of some clues on finding snow snakes this Christmas? Yeah. It is... sort of, I recall, it's going a little bit orthogonal, if you will, to the normal thrust of the things you're counting at Christmas. So it's not a new thing exactly, it's just a different thing that's being counted. I'm sorry, it's not a new thing that's being counted there, it's just a different way of counting a thing which you are already working on. And it just hasn't, you know, gotten to the levels it needs to on that count. But I have full faith that you will eventually unlock them, so I'm not super worried about it. There's a number of different methods controlling the rate at which techniques are learned, but it feels like lately, for a lot of different techniques, as long as you meet the trigger condition and have all known instances of the technique in your active deck, you have 100% chance of learning the new instance. Do you think this is likely to continue to be the case going forward? It depends on exactly how that technique is going in. There are quite a few different approaches that we have, like obviously there's that one. There's sort of a semi-standard one that gets used a few times in, like, techniques where there is a technique, and then, like, if you use a certain weapon or something along those lines, you'll get, like, a sort of almost an improved version of that technique. Those tend to work in a pretty coherent way in regards to at least each other. And then there's, like, the ones that you get for taking Eclipse in various circumstances and stuff like that. There are actually enough undiscovered techniques in some places that it isn't, you won't necessarily see all of them. You won't necessarily see all of the patterns, because I think you're missing a lot of puzzle pieces. But there are, both because I'm a jerk and because, like, there's several different, like, paths to get these techniques. Like, there are a few different patterns that are applied with varying degrees of consistency. And I think as you get more and more techniques, like, that'll sort of Fond plays. And that's not like a great mystery or anything. Like, it's just there are sort of like, I guess, different feels I'm going for with different techniques. Normally, skills and techniques learned are permanent until a reset, but in order to learn Starry Gaze, you have to trade in instances of Evil Eye, and to learn Stellar Appreciation, you have to trade in Art Appreciation. It's a bit different, but there are time skills with the Orbital Watch. Do you have any ideas in mind for other things that will use similar mechanics, where skills or techniques might be traded in for other things? Yeah, definitely. I don't think we're going to see anything like a sort of broad basis of that, where it's like, you know, trade in five techniques to get like this, you know, super technique or something like that. But we might very easily see something like, you know, trade in five punches to get a like sweet karate punch thing, right? Like, obviously, that's an example. I will probably not have a technique called karate punch because that sounds awful on a number of levels, but you might get some things like that. I don't think there's anything outstanding that does that. Like, I think everything that works like that has been discovered, but it's particularly with techniques, I think that it's an interesting way to have those sort of change and evolve with your experiences, which is pretty cool. It's something that wouldn't entirely surprise me if it would help the game if I went back and did that with some of the older techniques as well. Looking at, like, Crushing Punch here and things like that. Like, if they, you know, actually upgraded the punch and then, like, replaced itself in the deck or something like that. But I don't have any particular plan to do that. But I would expect to see not a ton of it going forward, but definitely it's very much open moving forward. Hi, Kinnick. Hope you've had a great summer. Yeah, it was a lot of travel and slow on the Metroplexity front, as summer is wont to be, but I got a lot of other stuff done and a lot of moving around done. So, yeah. It's pretty good. Downtown questions. Are there some patrons in the cellar door immortal, or do they just have to have a bunch of people identically dressed like spiders or demons? Those are actually represent multiple people. It's not weird. It's not like a mistake or anything that you can fight like multiple of the Yakuza dude or like There is some text that may or may not have been uncovered yet that tells you a little bit more about why the spider ladies are like that. The bouncers, I don't think exactly explain themselves, but there's sort of a background reason for that as well. Is there any way to stare down the rude spider lady successfully? There should be. It's always possible that it's not working, but there is one coded in. No hacked signal found in the cellar door yet. Is that something that is coming? Yes, very much. I'm not sure. I may have been smart enough to not mention them, in the running text yet. God, I might have even been smart enough to have it turn on when they launch, but don't quote me on either of those things. But there is another organization in the cellar door that will get rolled out there at some point. I won't promise before Halloween because it's going to be pretty big, and part of that will involve the hacked signal in the cellar door. Cellar door is, sort of to downtown what like the lot across the street is to Old Town. So, yeah, carries most of that burden. There's it's spread out along some other places too. Downtown is pretty huge, but it's definitely the largest and most involved of those areas. So there is still, basically that group needs to be added to the cellar door still. And then start to see more, stuff on the surface of downtown. Slags questions. Okay. The fourth floor of the damaged buildings is the only place where twisted hands show up when you are sober. So something significant about this floor specifically we'll be able to dig into later. We are close to the source of the incident, obviously, but why the fourth floor and not the first or second? I mean, keep in mind that, to some degree, it's a question of where the hounds are. But there is, I mean, certainly some special stuff with that building, and what's going on there, and its relationship to things overall, but I wouldn't expect to see a ton specifically digging into the fourth floor. On a global scale, how big a deal was the Slags incident? International newsworthy? New York tried to hush it up, and how successful were they? Yeah, definitely international newsworthy. Not like... Well, the sort of thing that would depend a lot about what else is going on in the news cycle, right? But the sort of thing that would be along the lines of, a major industrial accident nowadays, when there's a chemical processing plant a while back in Texas that just caught on fire and exploded. Not sure if anyone died in there, but it was pretty, pretty intense. I will assume people died. I don't know. Or when there's a, mine collapse that even that admittedly if there are trapped people down there and they get the drama, but it was a large enough event and enough people were killed that it definitely would have made international news. How long it would have stayed there would depend a lot on what else was in the news cycle. Midgard actually took a very different tact on it. Rather than trying to hush it up, they very much turned around, poured a lot of resources into getting things contained, like the wall around the Slags is all Midgard money and things like that. So they didn't exactly want coverage to go away. They just wanted it focusing how awesome they were being, and how much they were, helping the citizens of their city. Dr. Johnson only shows up on the fifth floor if you are told about him. Is that building big enough that could reasonably elude detection if you're specifically looking for him? Or does knowledge of him somehow reveal his presence? It's a pretty big building. And that goes back a little bit to Twisted Hound's question as well. It's not surprising to, until you start getting into the floors that are partially broken, it's pretty easy to get around and avoid people if you're not actively hunting them or being hunted. It seems we made less progress with a dusty clipboard than the orbital watch. Are there further rewards from the clipboard? Can we find them without the watch? There are definitely some interrelationships there, but I don't want to say nothing, but nothing huge? Nothing massive that is requires tying the two of them together. It's not like if you tie the two of them together, you get this whole extra path through it. In a grand sense, there are extra extra options, like some of the choices, to help things flow along, if you tie the stories together. But I would have to dig into what you found with the clipboard, but at the very least, there are quite a few techniques tied to it. And last I saw, you hadn't found all of them. So I would guess that there are still some hanging out there. Old Town resets take me a week or more. This is kind of frustrating. New content comes out the day after I reset, but I can't explore it for another week. Thoughts on giving a vague heads up on when new stuff is expected shortly. Allow dropping to casual mode where we can access all your stuff, but forfeit rewards for that run to quickly get to the end. So I can try giving a heads up, with the understanding that, I will, try to do it when I've been sort of on break for a bit almost, like when I'm, you know, releasing little chunks of something like Old Town, I'm getting at like the pace that I want. It'll be like every week or two something comes out. And those will hopefully be close enough together that a warning would be like, hey, I plan to do something else next week. And that's not, shouldn't be a particularly huge deal. I guess that shouldn't be like, I don't think that's particularly informative, but after I haven't done anything for a while, I will try to let people know like when I'm getting closer. But obviously, don't take that as like the word of God or anything, because creator of endeavors, often end up taking wild right turns when you're like 90% done. So I guess I can't claim that for everyone, but certainly it applies for me. So, can you describe the process of creating an unearthly item or content release from vague idea to finished project? Do you use pen and paper, post-it notes, Excel, or others? How fleshed out are items before you input them into the database? So most of my concepting, there are times that I will use pen and paper, like if we are at a design retreat. You can't see my air quotes, but they're definitely there. By which I mean, like, sometimes we'll get a cabin in the Hocking Hills, which is a really nice area in, like, southeastern Ohio that's beautiful and has canoeing and all of these things, and we'll get a cabin, and Liz will get a bunch of writing done. I'll get usually a bunch of design done, and then not, like, actually, like, development, because not so much with the database access, obviously. Most of the time it'll go into like Evernote, which is just a note-taking program that, I mean, syncs between my laptop and my phone so that wherever I happen to be, I can put stuff in there. And I do a lot of stuff in there, like daily design exercises, which generally aren't related to MetroPlexD or Twilight Heroes or Pathfinder or anything else. It'll just be like, okay, it's morning. I'm going to design, like, the basics of, like, a card game, and I'll do that, and then I'll move on to doing all of my other stuff to sort of get the juices flowing. As far as how fleshed out they get, it depends on, I mean, most of the stuff that I actually need to, like, code, I'll get, like, a very general outline and then move over into TextWrangler, which is the coding utility I use for PHP. For stuff that does end up in the database, more complicated stuff like techniques and choice encounters, I will generally outline them in sort of the language that I use for it. They're sort of broken up and interpreted. So like when you use a technique from your deck and it ends up doing something, it ends up having to decide like what it's going to do. There's basically a string of specially formatted text that I put in there that tells it where it'll end up going, right? Whether it does like, you know, reacts because there's an opening and it does this thing, or if it like, you know, is following another ranged technique, so it does this thing, whatever. So those I'll often like type out like that entire string, control string, I guess you're gonna call it that. They're just unhelpfully called flags. I just unhelpfully call them flags, which means like 80 different things in the code, because I'm a monster. But yeah, so items themselves, like the actual like item part, I'll usually just drop it in there. Like just start more or less typing straight into the database. But then techniques with choice encounters, those are have to be planned out a lot more in advance because they're very intricate. But then the sort of like the overall theme for the item is usually determined a while in advance. So I'll be like, okay, I want to do like a little dancing hut figurine that has a bunch of Baba Yaga stuff associated with it. And I'll be like, okay, got the figurine, and I've got like, you know, oh, I want to do some mortar and pestle and counting knuckle bones and, you know, chicken legs. And then I will get like a very, very basic outline there and break apart what art assets I need is really the first thing I end up doing, and get an art quest over to Puyo, because it'll be probably like 2 weeks or so before I get that back. So I will do a basic outline, send it over. When I get the art back, that's when I'll usually start digging into doing it. And that'll take me a goodly while, as you've seen, but that's when I'll burrow down fully into like, okay, so there's, you know, this technique with you know, hot stomp, and like this is sort of what it does, and I'll have generally like a sort of shorthand description of it when I did the initial design, but then I'll actually blow it out to like that sort of pseudocode that I use for it, and then dump that into the database and define like all of the other options. You can probably see a little bit with counting numbers for techniques that there are a lot of gaps there, like far more than just stuff that you haven't discovered in enemy techniques, because there'll be different forms of the technique, and it'll actually, there's sort of like the parent, and it will, and then that text that I'm putting in there will tell it like which of like the eight or whatever sub techniques it ends up actually using, or if it just sticks to the basic form, which is why you'll see like a lot of the etheric techniques will be like, yeah, this is zero base damage, because base form actually does jack all, right? Yeah, I'm sure there was something else I was trying to say there. But yeah, and then, so it'll be like real little outline, art request, art comes back, more like full outline, drilling into techniques and choice encounters. The other half of the thing I was trying to say is you end up making all of those little like sub techniques and then unifying them in the main underneath the base technique, so you can tell it where to go. So yeah, that's those are the ones that I end up doing a little more planning for. But with certain ones that are really not even really complicated necessarily, but like require like more in-depth like algorithms, like anything that has like procedurally generated content, things like that, that will generally, like, I'll have a lot more stuff about the code written out in advance in those cases. But most of the coding is just sort of like outline it in Text Wrangler and then start shooting in code and testing it, shooting in more code until everything is done or so broken that we can't even. And if you haven't mentioned already, any hints or plans in the next month or two coming up? So the last organization in the cellar door is going to come up. Obviously, Halloween is going to be the big thing. Maybe a little more cyberware, like I was talking about with crypto. Once the cellar door is done, some stuff up top will start being worked on. Not straight to Midgard headquarters, but some of the periphery locations. But that's a little further on. For like the next month or two, I would expect Halloween, last cellar door group, which might get sort of broken out to a couple of steps, depending on exactly how that goes. And, the next donation item is almost done, which is the last of the sort of trilogy of the current ones, which is a cool thing, and it's interesting, and I'm glad we did it, but they're all too big. And, like, even, like, the big idea getting split down into, like, three smaller ideas, each of those is still too big. We need to get donation items out there a little more frequently, both so that, like, you know, we can pay for things and also so that rotation happens at like a good speed. And oh, there's one last one that I was about to scroll past. What has been your favorite Halloween? That's a good question. The safe choice is probably, the first one, just because, like, really set the precedent and everything went to hell and it was kind of hilarious. I do have a certain fondness for, there was one that ended up being basically, I guess there were a couple of really close calls, but there's one in particular that I remember where it was basically like one choice on one choice encounter away from being a very different Halloween. And that was pretty cool. And I was watching along and biting my teeth. Well, biting my teeth, God, biting my nails. which thankfully I've been doing less of recently, but it was very much watching along and saw, like, oh yeah, it was basically like, you know, 49 instead of 50, which would have kicked off the even worse ending. Yeah, I guess I'm not going to say, like, they're all, you know, all of my children are beautiful and equal in my eyes. Because some of them were certainly, like, didn't really, like, land the same way. And I think I'm not sure if I'm willing to say that that's a price that we pay for, like, this, that sort of, like, player-driven, like, branching content. Because there's always stuff that I can do on my end to improve that and make even the, quote, you know, boring options a bit more engaging. But I guess it's not, even if it isn't, like, inevitable, it's not surprising that, like, there are some times where, you know, if I'm writing, like, you know, I'm not going to say 8 endings, because that's not exactly how that works, but if I'm writing, you know, 8 blocks of text for anything, 8, like, storylines or, like, intersections of storylines, then, I mean, they're not all going to be, like, evenly good. So it doesn't surprise me that from year to year, like, sometimes, you know, maybe the maybe the storyline where, you know, everything was nice and clean and everything was beautiful and glorious ended up being the one that was really, like, well written and engaging, and maybe, which admittedly, like, there's not, like, we don't do that in quite the same way anymore for that reason, in that the beautiful calm path of everything being totally fine seems to be unlikely to come up. But where am I going with that? Oh, but yeah, so it's not surprising some of them ended up better than others. But I think that there are a number of them that I do really like a lot. And a lot of them that I wouldn't mind sort of drinking out some contents of for, like, a greatest hits at some point, which to some degree is what I do, you know, every Halloween, like, sort of go back and pull up, like, cool bits from before. So it wouldn't surprise me if, like, maybe after a few years downtown, we'll go back to the university and, like, revisit some of that stuff and pull in threads that have gotten dropped there, that sort of thing. Anyway. Argath, any hints you can give us for old, undiscovered content? I think I said something earlier that I was like, oh, that's a good hint for old, undiscovered content. Damned if I can remember what it was, though. But you have been hopefully listening rather than talking. And you'll know. We flipped downtown, the source of the infection. Eclipse. Supplies for the third eye. I mean, we haven't gotten upstairs yet, but still. How challenging is it to try and build a somewhat lively part of town compared to the earlier, more sparsely populated parts? There's certainly there's some interesting challenges with the art that I know I've been throwing to Puyo. Thankfully, her art has gotten, has really improved a lot since, you know, the days when it was just Southside and that was it. But as far as, like, the actual design, I think it ends up being fairly similar at the grand scheme of things, but the related problem of there just being a ton of really interesting stuff downtown, it is problematic, which is why you're still sort of, you know, in the basement. And then, you know, once you pop up top, like, there'll be a number of clickable areas and a number of areas that won't necessarily get used right away, sort of like some of the warehouses on the docks. We're getting more at odds with forces into the town. So many gangs for NPCs. How many more are we planning to be able to interact with? Let's see. At least two more. There are two more that are pretty relevant. Let's say at least one more. There's some questions with exactly how I'm going to handle the content after downtown. And how there's a gang that is involved in a piece of future content that may be part of the main quest line after downtown, or it might be like add-on content afterwards. I think, that will be an interesting discussion to be had in my head at some later date. Yeah, so at least one more big significant one, and then you will see at least one more later, whether that's in the main quest or in after quest content. Who do we have to bribe to get bacon and eggs in this dystopian future? Yeah, you'd think like the least lattes could do is get you a bacon and eggs wrap or something, right? Friggin' dystopias. Fishing seems to be pretty popular in the outside edges of town, especially with this extreme bass pro. Shotgun Saints is popular with college kids. What's the major game played in downtown? I don't think you would see as much gaming downtown. It's primarily like a business area. That being said, don't, you know, be shocked if you find a pachinko parlor or something like that. But I would expect the games you'd find downtown would mostly be not those kind of games, but more along the lines of, like, augmented reality, just because there's a lot of people moving around all of the time. And their games are going to either be sort of like Metroplexity, which is really easy to play, you know, in a browser tab and switch away from it when your boss walks by. Not that I would suggest anyone do that, especially if they're stuck working at a help desk or something. But also, but other than that, yeah, augmented reality is a good option. And so, you're, like, when you're walking around the office or on your lunch break or whatever, you can sort of grab onto things. And it's on your comm, so you don't have to worry about doing it on your work computer and things like that. Could we get some kind of monthly hint system that just gives us a few more clues related to missing content each month until we actually find something? I mean, that's sort of what the news system is. Granted, it doesn't filter in new stuff or turn off on, like, a global level. But what I will say is that even when I'm not necessarily doing a podcast every month, and generally I don't think there's necessarily demand for a podcast every month, but even when I'm not doing a podcast every month, as long as I'm putting in content every month, very frequently new stuff will have callbacks in it that actually hook into earlier content and might reveal some of those techniques or skills or choices hidden along the wayside. Finding the ghost inmate in the asylum with a paper opener, which is supposedly silver, doesn't seem to cause anything different. Obviously, there's a different story aspect here than what's going on with the starship, the ghost ship, but is there anything hidden that we're missing? The ghosts on the ghost ship don't follow precisely the same rules as other spectral entities. Speaking of the asylum, how far off is that previously discussed rework? On one level, it would be like, it won't actually take that long, and I should just do it. On another level, like, I really want to get the main quest line done. And it would actually, for reasons that will become apparent once it's in, it would probably be good to drop it in either after the main quest line is done or, like, right around then. So that's sort of the warring thoughts. It's not currently on a front burner though, for whatever that's worth. Also, we've moved away from holograms and dorm crushing machineries the past few Halloweens. Usually there's a newer thing added in, like with the music system last year. Cybernetics seems the obvious choice this year, but obviously not every single student is going to be using cybernetic limbs, especially since it's a pretty permanent body mod. How common are decorative cybernetics like what the Fangs had? It depends a lot on sort of social class and that sort of signaling. The very disadvantaged, like, gang members, and I guess just people who want to signal themselves as being outside of normal society can get, obvious cybernetic mods, some of which are very cheap and do jack-all, some of which are a little more expensive and actually do stuff, as you found, with the, cellar door. But you will also find the extremely well-off sometimes using cybernetics as temporary decorative elements, even though that's obviously completely insane. And if you can hear conversation, that is just Liz talking to our cats. Also, how are you holding up? Life sure sounds busy. It is pretty busy. Going pretty good. I would say, well, I've gotten a number of writing projects offered and done with Pathfinder and Starfinder. Doing a lot of stuff with that, which is kind of interesting. If you check the about us and Metroplexity Games, it should link to my Board Game Geek profile, which has conveniently all of the projects that I've written. There's also a couple more that I've collaborated on or done conversions for and things like that. At least all the ones that are out yet. And I'm working on Shadows Over Vothic, which is sort of a Lovecraftian gothic horror Pathfinder setting. They needed a line developer for that to sort of shepherd things along. And I'm not going to say I volunteered because I am, you know, getting paid. That's a different, quite a different thing from volunteering. But I am working on that. Pretty cool. Just released the first sort of new product under my helm for that, I believe last month. Game Master's Guide to Inoth, a sort of like plague infested ruin of a country. There's just been a lot of that sort of stuff, and it's kind of interesting. I was having a talk with Liz few days ago about thing that I've said on this podcast a number of times, how like my the amount of work I get done isn't really capped by time, sort of capped per project, like sort of based on like the amount of energy and interest and investment that I have in that project. And I feel like I've managed to collect enough projects to actually like be able to see the time wall from where I am, which is good, because that means that I'm actually keeping myself busy, as it were, and not just like, you know, wasting time on, you know, social media and whatnot. So that's good. The creative juices are still flowing. I don't expect to take on any more like new, I don't want to say projects exactly, but like streams of work in the future. So probably, I mean, just Metroplex to Twilight Heroes, Shadows of Ravothic, and then like other Pathfinder and Starfinder stuff. And that's enough to keep me pretty busy, which is good. Keeps me out of trouble. Last question. We seem to have a very limited number of resetters right now. I admit I haven't been doing it as much as well, and with Halloween coming up, it's obvious why most people wouldn't be doing it. Is that a sign of the current health of the game, or are we still heading along with a steady core? Honestly, if I were like, the main problem with the health of the game right now is actually totally on me, and just what I was talking about earlier with the donation items, like, I just sort of like there's biting off more than you can chew, and there's just like shoving an entire T-bone steak into your mouth. Also, if there were weird clickings there, that was Zoe loving the laptop and it probably making weird and terrible noises. But she is adorable, so we forgive her. There's just biting off more than you can chew, and then there's biting off more than three times more than you can chew, right? Like, it's like, I bit off more than I can chew, and then it was like, wow, that's a terrible idea, and cut it into thirds, and it's still more than I can chew. That's pretty dumb. And the problem with that, besides causing some problems with, like, the resetting cycle, is also just sort of a financial thing. I was hoping to do some like light advertising for Metroplexity this year, but because I gave myself so many problems with that donation item, it ended up, that's probably just not gonna happen, unless, you know, in theory, I would like to release the last of that trilogy in October. Certainly not going to come out in September anymore, but in October, leading up to Halloween, although it's like only maybe very tangentially Halloween related, and then try to get in some more reasonably sized items in November and December. And actually trying to get more towards like a month cycle, which, if you remember me talking at the beginning of this year, is something that I was actually really, really keen to do. So hopefully, if we can do that and enough donations are coming in, we might still be able to do some advertising-y stuff. But if not, there's next year. I don't think that the game is going anywhere, in the away sense. It's definitely heading into downtown, obviously, and then from there into the true horrors that await ye. I should probably hang out with my spouse now that she is all home and whatnot. We're only like 20 minutes over where I was expecting, because I was talking about Japan for so long. But I hope that everyone enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for playing, and thank you for listening. Obviously, thank you for donating, particularly those of you who are still supporting the game, even though I can't get my shit together necessarily on the donation items. And I really appreciate that, and everyone's, I mean, sort of, particularly those of you who've been in here for the long haul, as it were. Yeah, that's not really fair. I love you all equally, unlike the different Halloweens. But yeah, I appreciate those of you who are playing, and those of you who are telling your friends about this awesome game, and everybody who's getting hyped for Halloween. And I will talk to you all next time, probably after Halloween, with a spooky post-mortem. I will see you then.